Welcome, friends. And as we always do, we welcome and thank John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for opening our show with the theme of change. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life. That's one of my credentials for being your host. I currently earn my pay as a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. And I also write columns for truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Please keep sending in your questions and comments. We read every single one. Not only do we select some of them to respond to, as I will later today, but we also use your comments and questions in shaping our programs. So please send them to me either at my own website, rdwolfwith2fs.com, or the new website that we're kind of making a transition to, and so we are urging you even more to think about that in terms of sending your comments. It's simply democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O, democracyatwork.info. It's a new website that assembles everything you might want to know about workers' self-directed enterprises, co-ops, things like that, that we believe are extremely important to our future. And as always, let us know whether you would like us to identify you by name. Our first update today is actually going to be very short because we're going to come back to it towards the middle of the program. Over the last week, the following three facts were announced by the United States government. First, there was the announcement that in the last quarter of 2012, the United States economy actually shrank. That is, the total quantity of goods and services produced was less than it had been in the previous quarter. That's called economic decline, a shrinkage of the GDP. The growth of our economy has become negative. The second important report over the last week was that the unemployment rate went from 7.8% up to 7.9%. In other words, a larger percentage of our labor force is without work. And the third important statistic, actually reported both by the government and by the New York Stock Exchange, was a record high of the stock market. So stocks are going up while the U.S. economy and employment are getting worse. And so that does represent a conundrum, and we will come back to analyze that later. Let me turn next to another statistic that was announced very recently, which not only tells you something about what's happening in the United States, but more generally in many parts of the world. But we'll begin with the United States statistic here. In 2004, so roughly 10 years ago, 100,000 young people, or indeed people of many ages, applied to go to law schools in the United States. 100,000 people applied to enter law school to become a lawyer. What is the estimate, based on what law schools are telling us, of the number of people applying to go to law school in 2013, the current year? Answer, 54,000 people. In other words, the number of people applying to law school in the United States has dropped by half over the last 10 years. Why? And before I answer, let me make sure you understand that similar numbers are being reported for many kinds of post-college advanced degree education, particularly in graduate schools, which are the places where we train the teachers in our colleges and universities. What is happening? Two answers. One, it has become impossible for an increasing number of students in the United States, and I suspect this is happening in many other countries, it has become increasingly difficult to pay for higher education, with the result that in order for an individual to undertake the years and the effort and the deferred income of getting a higher education, they're going to have to borrow huge sums of money. Second important fact. When you look at the job prospects of a young person who's done that, who's incurred the debts and gotten the education, and what jobs they can expect, those have been systematically declining over the last 10 years. Third, if you look at the income that you can get if you get a job, it has been declining too, dramatically in the case of lawyers, but the same is true across the board. So, over 10 years, what have we got? Higher than ever costs of going to school and incurring debt to do so, at the same time that your prospects for a job and for the income from a job, if you got one, were shrinking. No wonder that we're seeing the spectacular shutting down of our higher education system in a dramatic way. And what's the meaning of it? Well, it's bizarre. Every single reasonable observer of the American economic future says something like the following. We now live in a world economy. We have competition from Europeans, from Japanese, from Chinese, from India, from all over the world. And one of the key things that will determine how well the United States or any country does will depend on the quality and the quantity of educated, skilled young people coming out of colleges and universities. So how are we preparing for a future that depends on what comes out of our colleges and universities? By dramatically destroying the incentive to go there. The cost is too high, the borrowing is too enormous, the jobs you can get too few, and the income you can get too little. We are shooting ourselves in the foot. And if you assume, as I do, that the United States and other countries going through this experience are just as smart and clever and interested and committed as anybody else, you'd have to find an explanation for why, in the face of an economic downturn that we have, in the face of our future that depends on our colleges and universities, we are responding to a short-term economic crisis by shooting ourselves in the foot for the long run. That's a sign of a society spinning out of control. It's very serious, and it is something I want you all to think about. Our second update for today has to do with unemployment. Of course it does, because it's a lingering problem of enormous importance. Somewhere between 10 and 20, or maybe even more, million Americans, there's a big debate among statisticians, are unemployed. It is a staggering fact about our economy, a staggering inefficiency. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, over the last week, we were told that it's actually gone up in the last month from 7.8 to 7.9% of our labor force, our full-time unemployed people. Conservative folks have developed an argument that is part of the general approach called blame the victim. And here's how it works with unemployment. The conservative folks want us to believe that the reason we have millions and millions of people unemployed, way more than we had, say, in 2007, the last year before this crisis hit, has to do with something that's their personal fault. The argument goes, they're not working, they are unemployed, because they lack the appropriate skills, they lack the appropriate training. By the way, it's an interesting argument if you think about what I just finished saying, that we're making college and higher educations impossible for people to get. So, of course, we're going to now blame them for not having what we've made it impossible for them to get. But put that aside. Is there any merit to the idea that unemployment could be the fault of the unemployed because they lack skills, that if only they lacked skills, they wouldn't be unemployed? Well, I came across a study And I want to thank the person who did it, Heidi Scheerholz. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She works for the Economic Policy Institute, a longstanding think tank and research outfit in Washington, D.C. And she asked herself a simple question, and she found the answer, and I want to share it with you. She compared unemployment in 2007 with unemployment in 2012. In other words, how did unemployment change over the 5 years of the crisis that we are still living with? And here's what she did. She compared what happened to unemployment among people who don't even have a high school education, people who have a little bit of college, people who finished college, and people who went on to do studies beyond college, higher education, a graduate education. And you'll be interested to know what she found. Basically, comparing 2007 to 2012, the rate of unemployment doubled for all the groups. In other words, it went up just as much for people with PhDs as it did for people with a BA degree from college or people who just barely got through high school or didn't even do that. In fact, and I found this cute, since I am one of those people with a PhD, is that the unemployment rate in PhDs doubled, whereas the unemployment rate for people without a high school education went up a lot, but not quite so much. So it turned out that the PhDs were not immune from the unemployment. The problem of our economy isn't that you don't have enough education. The problem of our economy is there aren't enough jobs, and there aren't enough jobs for everybody, whether you have a lot of education, a little bit of education, or none at all. And so the argument of blaming people that they didn't get the right education is a mistake. This is a crisis that affected everybody and cannot and should not be blamed on those who have suffered the most from it, namely the unemployed. The third update for today has to do with an issue that many of you want me to talk about, and that has to do with the role of money in shaping politics in general and our elections in particular. And so I was happy to learn of the publication this last month of a very important document. It was produced, and I'm happy to give credit, by the Demos Foundation. You can get them at Demos, D-E-M-O-S.org on the web. And they produced a remarkable document. It's called Billion Dollar Democracy: The Unprecedented Role of Money in the 2012 Elections, and they mean the presidential elections. The authors are Paul Caron and James Rapetti. And here are some of the things they found. It won't surprise you, but it's interesting because this is the first presidential election since that famous Supreme Court case, Citizens United, which allowed unlimited contributions by wealthy people. And wealthy institutions and corporations to these things that we now call super PACs, P-A-Cs, political action committees. So here's some numbers for you to think about. The top 32 donors, that is the top 32 people or institutions that gave money to these political action committees, gave an average of $9.9 million each. Now let's do the math. These 32 people gave a total of $313 million, which is the exact amount that both President Obama and Republican candidate Romney raised from all of their small donors combined. 3.7 million people who each gave less than $200. So the next time anyone tells you that we're a political system that depends on little people throwing their money in to make a difference, the 3.7 million people, that's the 99.9% of all the people who gave any money to the candidacies, all together gave the same amount of money that the richest 32 did. Wow. Those 32 people bought access, proved to the political parties that in our society, 32 rich people have as much money to invest in politics as the 3.7 million people who give little contributions. Here's some other statistics that come from this report. 84% of those candidates running for the House of Representatives in the United States this last November, 84% of those who won also got more money than their opponents. So if you're wondering whether getting contributions helps you win, there's your answer. In the Senate, over two-thirds of those who won had received more money than the people they defeated. Every politician knows that the money you get and the media support and help you can hire to run your election, those will determine the outcome the bulk of the time. But here are the statistics to prove it. So, of course, politicians have to pay close attention to where the money comes from. And the money now comes from an enormously wealthy, tiny group of people. And all the statistics to show that are in this new publication. Again, it's titled Billion Dollar Democracy: The Unprecedented Role of Money in the 2012 Elections. All right, let me turn then, as we always do in this program, to some of the topics that deserve a little more elaborate attention. And I'm going to begin with this week's jobs report, the report of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, dated February 1, 2013. And let's pick up from where we began today. Over the last week, the total output of goods and services in the United States shrank, the unemployment rate rose, and yet the stock market had its best day in a long time. All of that, February 1, 2013. What's going on? I think we have to now, with these statistics in mind, take a look at the crisis of the last 5 years. We had a major collapse of our capitalist economic system that got extremely severe in the last third of 2008 and into the first third of 2009. Things almost grinded to a halt in terms of the daily life of people living, particularly in the United States at first, and then it spread to Europe and so forth. What was done was remarkable. The private capitalists who run this economy, led by our leading bankers and our leading insurance companies, in other words, our financial industry, did something surprising, because they had been talking for decades about how the private sector is the source of prosperity, and the private sector is the source of economic growth, and the government is simply a burdensome drag on all of the great things that private enterprise can achieve. So here we had a spectacle of the same men, and there are also a few women among them, but the same men who had been making the same boring speech over and over again, were leading the rush to Washington to beg and plead with the government they had been denouncing to save them, to bail them out, to help recover from the ungodly mess they had made in every financial sector of our economy. What a spectacle. But because they're very rich and they're very powerful, they got the government to do what they wanted. The government used taxpayer money, the power of the government to control the money supply, the interest rates, things like that, to bail out the financial sector, to give them outright gifts, cheap, cheap loans, investments, everything they needed to recoup. We've had a spectacular stimulus program started under President Bush and expanded under President Obama. 5 years later, what do we have to show for it? Very interesting. Words like recovery have been used, but it's easy to show what a shallow mistake that is. In 2007, for example, unemployment was under 5%. In 2009 and 10, it zoomed up to 10%. And yesterday, it was reported to be 7.9%. We'll do the math, friends. 7.9% isn't even halfway back from the how bad it got to where it was before the crisis hit. So we haven't even gotten halfway back to where we were, and where we were wasn't good. And we've spent an enormous amount of money, trillions of dollars to do it. The government has entered into the economy to shore it up, to keep it going, to try to sustain and fix a private capitalism that went right off the rails. And we don't have much to show for it. We haven't done real well. Well, the stock market has. Yes. The stock market zooms while the total output of goods and services shrank and unemployment rose, and it's still not even halfway back from the worst of the crisis to where it was before the crisis hit. You know what that means? That means uneven development. It means that for people who play in the stock market, for the people with the money to buy significant numbers of shares, and that's a tiny percentage of the American people, they got a recovery. Their stocks are worth something again. But for the mass of people who are suffering unemployment, home foreclosures, jobs with fewer benefits, lower wages, they're not getting out of the depths. Their situation isn't looking good. Their children can't afford school. We just went through that. So we have an uneven situation, benefiting a few at the top at the cost of the vast middle, and Lord help those at the bottom. But there's more here that needs to be confronted and faced. How can a stock market be doing well if the unemployment is worsening and the country's total economic output of goods and services is shrinking? And the answer is we have disconnected the well-being of America's corporations, whose shares are on the stock market, from the condition of the American economy. And that's because more and more American corporations, the big ones who dominate, and all the medium and small ones who basically serve the big ones, they're now more and more dependent on things happening outside the United States, on producing over there where you can pay workers much less, on storing and equipping with goods purchased over there which you can buy for less, with spending your advertising dollar over there. Why? Because over there, particularly in Asia and in parts of Europe and Latin America, people have money to spend and people have more money to spend. So that becomes the growing market to which American corporations pay attention compared to the American market where high unemployment and falling wages, when you adjust for prices, and that's what we have, are making markets atrophy, shrink, get smaller. Corporations go where the money is, and there's enough money in the world for the stock market in America to go up. But there's not enough business in the United States to keep our factories humming, our offices full. Final point, and it's the one I always stress. We currently have in the United States 10, 20, maybe even 30 million people unemployed in one way or another. That's a staggering inefficiency in using people who want to work, who need to work. But that's only the beginning. From the Federal Reserve of the United States comes that important statistic, capacity utilization. What portion of the goods, and by goods I mean tools, equipment, means of production, fleets of trucks, all the stuff we need to produce with. What portion of it is being used and what portion of it is sitting idle? That's what capacity utilization means. And according to the Federal Reserve that keeps this statistic, 20% of our desks, of our computers, of our trucks, of our office space, our store square footage, our factories, are sitting idle, gathering rust and dust. Because if you don't use tools, equipment, and raw materials, they mostly deteriorate. So we've got huge amounts of equipment available, not being used, that could be used for production. We have tens of millions of our fellow citizens who want nothing other than to get a job using those tools and equipment to transform that raw material into what? Into wealth, into output. We could have, and the number is measured in trillions, an output of goods and services that could rebuild our cities, transform our public education, provide a solution to poverty, not only in the United States, but we could help other countries and become a champion in the world. If we just put together the people who want to work with the tools and equipment they need to work with, and our capitalist economic system cannot or will not do it. What good is it to be very efficient in producing razor blades if at the same time you got millions of people with no work at all? The efficiency in the private enterprise is offset by the grotesque inefficiency of the economy as a whole. That is a fundamental critique of an economic system, and the statistics this week bring it home in a major and powerful way. Final point on this. Sometimes when the enormity of this problem is allowed into the public discussion of the United States, and that isn't very often, friends, but when it is, you hear well-intentioned people throw up their hands and say, yes, yes, it's correct, it's terrible, but what can we do? The government is already trying in every way to stimulate and to make it interesting and profitable for private employers to hire people. But for whatever reason, and it's sort of mysterious, they're not doing it. Well, folks, there's one thing worse than unemployment, and that is the idea that there's nothing you can do about it. Of course there's something you can do about it. There's lots of things you can do about it. We as a society don't want to face that, and the reasons for that are worth thinking about. But let me give you again the simplest, obvious answer drawn from American history. The last time the United States faced a level of unemployment as high, as long-lasting, and as resistant to government efforts as this one, the president then of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat like Mr. Obama, went on the radio and he said to the American people, if the private sector, you know, private enterprises, private employers, either cannot or will not hire unemployed people, then, and please note, these are the words of the president, then there's no alternative but for the government to do it, and that's what I'm going to do. And President Roosevelt was good to his word. Between 1934 and 1941, he created and filled at least, and there's some debate about the numbers, at least 12.5 million jobs. That's right, federal government jobs. The government went out, and guess what? It solved the unemployment problem. That thing which folks say we can't do, they did it, big time. For millions of families, it meant a job. It meant the self-confidence, the self-esteem, the self-respect that goes with it. For millions of American communities, it meant they didn't drown in an unemployment problem. Because the government hired people and paid them a salary, they paid taxes to their towns and cities, who could therefore keep their schools and hospitals going. Because they had a job with the federal government and got an income, they could make their mortgage payments and weren't thrown out of their homes. It transformed people's lives. It solved the problem. Is it the best way? No. But is it better than letting people be unemployed the way we are, losing the output we could have earned, wasting the raw materials and equipment? Sure it is. And the tragedy and the scandal of our time is that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats say a word about it. It's as if we've had a national amnesia. There are many other ways to solve unemployment, but don't let anyone tell you it can't be done, it exceeds our capacity, it's a mysterious affliction. It's none of those things. It's a political problem, and that ought to give people time and something to think about. Please stay with us across our musical interlude. We'll be back in a minute.
Sitting in church in a wooden chair, I knew nobody would look for me there. Sorrow and pity through the earth and the skies, looking for nothing anyone's eyes. Once I had pretty girls did me wrong. I'm out trip to the city and the road ain't long.
Thanks to Bob Dylan, Marching to the City, one of his less well-known but remarkable pieces of poetry set to music. The next major item I want to talk about, besides that jobs report and all that it raised about the questions of unemployment, has to do with the medical industry and the economics of the medical industry. And I want to bring some items to your attention and then tell you what I think they mean in economic terms. It hasn't been a good week for one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world and active across the world. It's known as Johnson & Johnson. And it could take me 10 minutes to give you all the familiar names from Tylenol and on of goods that they produce and sell globally. But they had a rough week, and I want to tell you about it. First, one of the subsidiaries of Johnson & Johnson is called Dupuy, D-E-P-U-Y, Dupuy Orthopedics. They're famous for having produced an all-metal hip implant. Increasingly, older people around the world are having problems with their hips, and a solution widely used is hip replacement. They actually get the implant of an all-metal hip, and one of the producers of that is Dupuy Orthopedics. The estimate that I saw was that 93,000 of these metal hips have been implanted in people. So then you will be struck when you discover that there are now outstanding 10,000 lawsuits against this company for the faulty functioning of the hip implant. It didn't work well. It caused suffering and pain on a massive scale. So why is Johnson & Johnson in the news? Because of the lawsuits? No. Because of the actions of the courts, because it has become clear, enough to initiate lawsuits at least against Johnson & Johnson by the prosecutors in Los Angeles, that the chief executive, Andrew Ekdahl, is accused of having known it was faulty, of having tried repeatedly to not respond to the information that was coming in about its faults, having tried to blame surgeons for having not implanted it properly. All of that didn't work. First the FDA in Washington, then the New York Times in an important news story exposed it all, and now they're in court defending themselves against heavy evidence that they placed in the bodies of tens of thousands of people items they knew to have serious problems, metal implants. Later last week, Johnson & Johnson achieved the following. A story on February 1, New York Times, page B1. I'll read you the first paragraph, and that's all that has to be said. European antitrust officials on Thursday accused the drug giants Johnson & Johnson and Novartis of colluding to delay the availability of a less expensive generic version of a powerful medication often used to ease severe pain in cancer patients. Let me explain. When a drug company puts a new drug on the market, they get a certain number of years during which nobody can produce the equivalent, making the same chemical compound, and sell it at a fraction of the price. After a certain number of years, that protection of the big rich drug companies stops, and anybody who can produce that chemical can produce it and market it. That's why when you go to your drugstore, you often are told, do you want the brand name or do you want the generic? The brand name, it's exactly the same compound. It can do exactly the same in your body. Do you want to pay the brand price, which is often 10 times what the generic is? So we're not talking anything even roughly comparable. So what Johnson & Johnson is accused by the antitrust officials in Europe of doing together with Novartis is basically making sure, often by payments to chemical companies, that they don't produce a generic for a while, for an indefinite period of time, so that the only way a cancer patient can get the medicine that will ease severe pain is by paying a much higher price than it would cost the generic producer to do that. Wow. Is it just a problem with Johnson & Johnson? No, of course not. Recently, another story surfaced in many papers. This one has to do with the Hospital Corporation of America, the United States' largest profit-making hospital chain. It was required by a judge in Missouri, in Kansas City, to pay a fine of $162 million. Why? What did it do wrong? Well, it turns out that the following is happening, and what a comment on America it is. In city after city, Kansas City is hardly alone, the finances of cities and towns are in such trouble because of the crisis, because of all the unemployment. That means people don't have an income, so they don't pay taxes. They don't buy as much as they used to. So cities and towns don't get the tax revenues. The value of property is falling, so they don't get the taxes on the property. So cities and towns are really jammed up, and they don't have enough money to pay for the schooling and the fire department, the police department, all of it. So one of the things they're doing is saying, oh, well, we're losing money on the public hospitals where we provide care for people, so we'll sell them. That way we won't be losing money. And when we sell them, we get a little chunk of money, too, that'll help us in this time of difficulty. In short, they privatize their hospitals. And who buys them? Well, Hospital Corporation of America. And so when you move your hospital from public, run by the city, where you know you have to serve everybody because that's what the city is there for, to serve all the people who live there, not according to whether they can pay for it, but because they're citizens of the community, they have the right to go to the community hospital since it's their taxes that help pay for that hospital to be there. So what happens if the city sells the hospital? Well, it goes from being a community facility to service the community paid for by everybody's taxes into a profit source, into a business for a profit-making company. So what happened here was that the HCA Corporation bought the Kansas City hospitals, and of course, when the citizens were worried what would happen to our medical care, what will happen to our hospital that we have to go to in every emergency, when our child gets sick, when our ancient mother has a problem, whatever. Oh, the HCA Corporation promised. We will expand the facility. We will take care of everybody. We'll do it even better than the city. We will, we will, we will. And now a judge in Kansas City requires them to pay $162 million. You know why? Because they didn't do what they promised to do. That's not so unusual, unfortunately. What's unusual is they got caught. And people went to the judges and they made such a stink that at least in Kansas City, something will be done to begin to make a corporation that's in the business of hospital and medical care to make money does for the people what they used to get from their community facility. Privatization is a very complicated process. And anyone who believes that going from the public to the private is a one-way guarantee of better service at a lower price isn't paying attention. Is this the only time HCA got caught doing this? Turns out not. Turns out in 2011, another judge in another state, New Hampshire, got a case like this, and that there were other problems in other parts of the United States. So this is a problem that exists on a widespread level. Well, what does the Johnson & Johnson behavior with the hip implant and the cancer pain medication, what does it have to do with the HCA Corporation and what it did with those public hospitals in Kansas City? The answer is profit and the profit system. We live in a country in which celebrating profit and profit-making as the royal road to everything good is a religion. But it doesn't work, and it isn't true, and it never has been. Going from non-profit to profit is just that, from an arrangement in which you are financed by taxes and serve a community to an arrangement where you are served by the fees a company charges and you're served by a private profit-making company. And that introduces all kinds of changes, and it may mean, in some cases, better service. But it is just as likely, and all these examples show it, that you're going to get worse service. What's the solution? Well, think with me for a moment about it. Suppose the companies that made hip implants or cancer medication or ran our hospitals didn't have to worry about profit. That their job was actually to take care of people, to help you with your hip, to service a reduction of pain for your cancer, and to make sure you have an emergency room and a hospital to go to. Suppose that were the main goal, not making profit. Suppose the companies that produced hip implants were told you're part of a health service system. So the minute you have any reason to believe that the hip that you're producing isn't working well, and remember this company got thousands of complaints. The minute you have evidence it isn't working well, stop producing it. It's not going to affect your existence as a company. It's not going to lose you business, and it's not going to lose you profits, and it's not going to lose you jobs. We'll put your people to work on all the other medical problems we have in our society. So you'll stay in business, you'll produce something else, we'll get scientists to work with you. Your jobs will be preserved. But we'll not be in the position of your being so afraid of losing profits that you keep putting hips that don't work, causing pain and suffering to people in order to hold on to your profits, which is what's driving you. And you won't take over a hospital and deprive people of the services they need during a crisis more than ever because it's dictated by your profits, by that famous, or maybe I should say infamous, bottom line. Wow. We need to understand that introducing a profit system is at best a mixed bag. In some cases, it may help. In many cases, it does the opposite. We have to grow up, face that, and stop imagining that we found the magic bullet in privatizing. The behavior of the HCA Corporation, one of the biggest corporations in America. The behavior of Johnson & Johnson, one of the biggest corporations in America, is screaming testimony that the profit motive, particularly in medical care for people, is a very dangerous institution. Let me turn now, as we always do at this time in the program, to things that respond to your questions, comments that you send us. The first has to do with a feature I'm trying to introduce to our programs, which is to give you concrete examples, briefly, of enterprises that are not organized in the usual hierarchical top-down capitalist way. That is, they don't work with a tiny number of major shareholders who select a board of directors of 15 to 20 people who make all the basic decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. And you know, earlier, last year particularly, we devoted a couple of programs to what is arguably the largest and most successful of enterprises organized instead in a cooperative and democratic way. And that is the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain, with its over 100,000 employees, you know, the seventh largest corporation in the whole country of Spain, and so on. But I want to make sure that you know that there are many, many examples across the world, and that many of them are smaller businesses. Indeed, last week, I spoke briefly about the New Era Windows Company, 26 workers in Chicago who make windows and who also run their business as a cooperative. And so today I want to give you yet another example. And by the way, all of these examples are listed and discussed with the websites where you can learn more about them provided at our website, democracyatwork.info. So you can go there and find out about these examples that I give you, but also vast amount of information collected there for your use about workers' self-directed enterprises. So the one I want to mention today is called the Community Builders Cooperative, and they are located in Somerville, Massachusetts. Somerville is a suburb of Boston. And here's what these folks do. I believe it includes now 10 folks. They build homes. They build additions on homes. They are carpenters. They are builders. And here's how they describe themselves. Our business is organized as a cooperative. I'm quoting. The workers are the owners of the business, and each worker has an equal say in running the company. CBC, that stands for Community Builders Cooperative, works closely with and supports community development groups promoting affordable housing and sustainable development. We take pride in being a worker-owned, socially responsible business. How interesting. They've been going for over 25 years. They are a successful, durable company. And they run themselves without outside investors, without a top-down hierarchy. They are their own boss in a cooperative enterprise. And because they believe in it, they work together with people who care about the environment, to do sustainable work, to respect the natural environment. And they do so in a way that supports institutions in their community whose beliefs they share. Interesting. To advance their goals environmentally and socially, they also organize their enterprise in a democratically worker-owned, worker-run way. I will be giving you more examples in the weeks and months ahead. Finally, I want to answer some questions that came, and they are particularly timely and important today. First, a quote was sent to me, and this is a quote from a very famous writer, and says the following, that in this age of bankrupt capitalism, we're going to have to return, this writer believed, to the work of Karl Marx, who was a critic of capitalism, and therefore has insights we need to build on. But the quote also associates with Karl Marx the following, he advocated violence and he worshipped the state as the utopian mechanism to lead to a better society. And the questioner wanted me to comment about this representation of Marx. So let me do that. I am not going to shy away ever on this program from talking about Marx and Marxism. The Cold War is over. The great enemy of the Soviet Union is gone. There wasn't much justification for ignoring and denying the importance of Marx, even when that wasn't true. But now that we are basically 20-odd years out of our Cold War struggle, there's absolutely no justification. Marx was an important thinker in the world. The work he wrote and the items he figured out have been influential in the world, and no mature thinker can afford to ignore what that's about. It's not a question of agreeing with it. It's a question of learning what has to be said by someone who's critical of the system. Because Marx has had an enormous influence across the world in every country, we have the following obvious situation. Marx, born in Germany, lived most of his adult life in Great Britain, a theorist who died in 1883, has now been picked up, been found to be interesting, important, insightful, in cultures as varied as Scandinavia, China, South Africa, Ecuador, and you fill in the blank because every other country in the world has been influenced. So if all this influence happened, then you can be sure that Marx and Marxism have been interpreted in radically different ways. By the way, the same is true, for example, of the Muslim religion. How it is interpreted in one country by one group of Muslims is different from how it has been interpreted in other countries and in other groups who are also Muslim, who also read the Quran, who also take Muhammad very seriously, but interpret it differently. The same is true of Christianity, right? Protestants and Catholics, for example, disagree, and Baptists and Methodists have their disagree, and so on and so on. And the same is true of Marx. If you wish to represent Marx or Marxism, you are therefore confronted with something that only ignorance would allow you to deny. Namely, you've got to choose which of the alternative interpretations you find persuasive. There aren't too many people who on one Sunday go to the Catholic service, the next Sunday the Baptist service, the next Sunday the Quaker service, right? People choose whichever one they either were born into or find persuasive, and so it is with Marx. Now to answer the question, were there interpreters of Marx and Marxism who advocated violence? Yes. Were there interpreters of Marx and Marxism who worshiped the state in the way this quotation suggests? Yes. But here comes the problem, dear friends. There were people who interpreted Marx to not be in favor of violence and to not worship the state. So I, for example, as someone who has read Marx and taken it very seriously and benefited enormously in my understanding of what's going on by virtue of that study, I don't interpret Marx in that way at all. I don't think he endorsed violence, and I don't think he worshipped the state. There's a reason, by the way, that Karl Marx never wrote a book or an article about the state. He didn't worship it. That wasn't his idea. His idea was you got to change the economic system. You got to change the way the system works, not the way the government works. He saw the government as shaped more by the system than the other way around. And so that's where he focused himself. But the point is not to persuade you of my particular interpretation, but to understand that any quotation, such as the one sent in to me, that acts as though you can say Marx believed X and you've got it, that's the same as having someone stand up and say, I'm going to talk to you about religion, then begin to talk to you about, say, pick one, I don't know, Roman Catholicism, and act as if it were the only one. That's not true. It is one, for sure, but it's not the only one. And the interpretation of Marx as having something to do with state worship or violence is an interpretation people have made, but it's not the only one, and it shouldn't be dealt with as if it were. Finally, question as follows. Some people with a libertarian bent have written into the program and said, you shouldn't criticize capitalism as if it existed, because in the United States we don't really have capitalism. A real capitalism would be small enterprises, and the government wouldn't be saving any of them, and we would have little businesses struggling against one another, and that would be real capitalism. My response to that is, look, it's a nice idea, but it has never existed. We've never had that kind of capitalism. And I understand what you're saying, that we don't have it now. You're right. But there's a reason why we've never had it. It's not workable. Capitalists have always turned to the government to help them. And they've always gotten governments to help them. And they've used those governments to help them. And when capitalists compete with one another, you know what usually happens? Some of them win and others lose. And the ones that lose go out of business. And when they go out of business, their workers get jobs with the one who won, who becomes bigger. And over time, capitalism erases itself. Many become few. We once had 50 car companies. Now we have 3 or 4. We once had 1,000 cigarette companies. Now we have 2 or 3. There's a reason this happens this way. And going back to an earlier capitalism is partly going back to a fantasy and partly trying to go back to something which never existed. And when we had something roughly like it, it self-destructed and built the big corporations we live with now. So we got to deal with that rather than imagining going backwards. Thank you, as always, for your attention. I look forward to seeing you again next week on Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, thanking you for being part of this program. One of these days, babe, I'm on and drawing, babe.